are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, March 29th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report, broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, David H. Weber, law professor at Boston University, author of The Rise of the Working Class Shareholder, Labor's Last Best Weapon. Can labor use its capital in pension funds to assert power and direct policy? We'll get into all of that with him. North Korean and South Korean leaders set to meet in April in a historical summit, fresh off of the North Korean leader's recent post-announced visit to China. Funeral for Stephen Clark begin today in Sacramento as protests and unrest continue. He was the unarmed 22-year-old black man who was killed in his grandmother's backyard holding a cell phone. And of course, that comes in light of no charges for the police in Louisiana and Baton Rouge, who killed an unarmed black man in a parking lot. HUD is scaling back fair housing enforcement. What a surprise. Maybe there are some things that I know how to do. Betsy DeVos is using school shootings to justify new draconian discipline measures. Another bleak non-surprise. And a new leaked memo from the EPA shows workers how to downplay climate change. There's actually a how-to guide for undermining science and currying favor for industry. Not sure if this is related to all of Scott Pruitt's travel expenses. And sorry, John, you're losing influence on me. Chief of Staff John Kelly, an eager and willing fascist and deeply disgusting person in and of himself, he apparently is losing favor in the White House as the all drama, all the time administration continues. Even as Trump's lawyer has raised the prospect of pardons for Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn. All that, as well as Sam Harris's melty down on today's Majority Report. But first, let's start with our old buddy, Alex Jones. He's been hitting the canvas. He's back. And this is actually a master class. And essentially, my read is pretty much sort of subtly, indirectly threatening violence, while also, especially for him, subtly and indirectly pleading to protect his business and continue his growth. Another thing that I really like about Alex Jones is that he is so on the nose with his, like, "No, I'm not doing it for this." And pretty much as soon as he says, like, "I don't want this," or "I'm not doing this for this," or "This isn't my goal," whatever then comes out of his mouth next, you can pretty much usually be like, "Oh, that basically explains why he's doing everything he's doing." So here is Alex Jones on InfoWars.
There's another saying, nobody knows who said it posthumously, but no guts, no glory. Well, I'm not looking for red carpets. I'm not looking for jet airplanes.
Pause it.
I'm not looking for...
See, that's what I mean. I think he is looking for red carpets and jet planes. That's what I'm saying. Go ahead.
Glory. Well, I'm not looking for red carpets. I'm not looking for jet airplanes. I'm not looking for people to kiss my old, ugly butt. But what I am looking for is living my own life. And all these control freaks and people that want to run my life, want to run your life, I say it's open season on them. Intellectually, culturally, economically. And if they jump across that line and they pull the first punch and they draw the first blood, then we give them everything they want. And it'll just be like rowing a boat up and down the stream, merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Because the tree of liberty is watered by the blood of patriots and tyrants.
That is like one of the most relaxed, indirect incitements to violence I've ever heard in my life. I like the pattern, like whether he's musing about somebody taking a shot at the president or whether he's talking about what they will do if the liberals keep pushing it. There's like this desire for things to pop off. But here's what I don't understand is I thought with Antifa meth heads, it was already happening. So, I mean, I'm not saying unlike him, I don't want there to be bloodshed in the streets. Or maybe he doesn't want, you know, actually, maybe Alex Jones is so peace loving. He's like the Gandhi of lunatics on YouTube. He really doesn't want it to turn out this way. But I just don't get the connection between if it happens, we're on it, versus saying that it's happening every single day. But hey, look, I don't do this for red carpets. I don't do this for private jets. What do you guys think? Matt, what do you think? And then our surprise visitor. Oh, that's good music. Really good. I dig it. No, it was cool. It was a little teaser.
What do I think?
Yeah, what do you think about of this what's going on here? Let's do the 30-second Alex Jones psychic breakdown of the day.
Well, I think the important thing is Alex Jones doesn't seem to be too worried about more retribution from like YouTube or something. Like he's really
nice. He's figured it out.
He's really leaning into this. He doesn't seem chastened.
They had a meeting where it was just like, all right, here's a new place. So here's what this is going to be. We're doing the David Hogg as a Nazi video. Forget it. I'm not even going to say it. Let's just literally dub. And then blood, Tree of Liberty, whatever. Brendan. Who is here today?
Hey, folks. Making a guest spot today.
Thank you.
Have a chance. You know, I haven't seen an Alex Jones clip in a month since I've been out of town.
How your psyche must be in such a better place taking a break from all this stuff.
But at the same time, there's a lingering desire to really just, you know, really get back with the devil.
Stare into the void. Stelter! Why? How terrible is it that I literally will think like I'll just be like, you know, walking on the street or out with friends or something, and all of a sudden I'll just think of Stelter. Just that picture of Brian Stelter being like, "Hi, I'm Brian Stelter. I'm interested in the media business," and Alex Jones being like, "I see you, devil."
Well, that's why it's funny seeing Ezra Klein get into it with Sam Harris, too. Like, these very...
That is the definitely the high-level version of, like, hi, I'm Ezra Klein. I am so superhumanly reasonable. And then Sam Harris, like, I'm superhumanly reasonable, except I'm not. I'm actually insane, and I'm a complete egomaniac. And anybody disagreeing with me is going to lead to a full-scale emotional psychic meltdown. And if you do that, then I'll release my emails where I show how insane I am.
He's apologized, or he said it's frustrating that people are taking the wrong message from those emails. I'll pull that up later.
I would imagine it is. Okay. Oh, my God. All right. We'll be back with David H. Weber on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Professor David Weber. He's a law professor at Boston University Law School, and he's the author of The Rise of the Working Class Shareholder, Labor's Last Best Weapon. David, and you have asked me to call you David. I would normally say Professor. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So let's start really basic here. What is this wealth that labor possesses? Where is it held? What kind of capital are we talking about here?
Well, in terms of dollar sums, it depends a little bit how you count it, but it's between $3 and $6 trillion in assets. And it is held in two primary forms. The main one is in the pension funds of state and local government workers. So folks who work for the state of New York or Massachusetts or California, or folks who work for, you know, New York City, L.A., Chicago, or smaller counties and cities across and towns across the country. And what these are, and then in the private sector, there are labor union funds, which are actually a lot smaller than the public ones, than the state ones. But what they are basically, in a nutshell, is they are the retirement savings of tens of millions of workers in this country. The number is around 30 million, I think. And these pension funds invest the retirement savings of these workers in, and ultimately they're responsible to pay for the retirements of these workers. And I think the bottom line of my book and what we're talking about in this topic is that they have actually become a source of enormous power for workers, and I think have played a really positive role in markets that a lot of people don't really, especially people who tend to focus on labor issues and worker issues, I don't think we pay enough attention to it, and I think it's really important.
Yeah, in fact, you're actually saying that this in some ways is, would you argue, the greatest, at the moment, I mean, dynamics can change, but the greatest concentration of just pure, you know, I mean, just, in fact, financial or even potentially political power that labor has at the moment?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, the obvious competing candidate would be the labor unions themselves, although they kind of operate in different ways and in different spheres, mm-hmm. and it's tough to make an apples-to-apples comparison. And it's also the case, as crucially important as unions are, I mean, they've been under kind of relentless attack, and a lot of us are worried about what the Supreme Court's going to do to public sector unions in this Janus case come right. June. So yes, I think right now, absolutely, it's a significant source of capital and therefore of power for workers.
How are these funds managed right now? Like who, you know, I was actually thinking of this. I watch the show Billions on Showtime from mm-hmm. time to time, which has mm-hmm. some very, very weird politics in that show. But one of the kind of funny dynamics that they play with in that show, and one of the things that sort of makes one of the main characters a kind of, you know, culturally populist billionaire, is that he handles fire and police pension funds
yep.
in his hedge. Mm-hmm. And so you do have this kind of funny relationship there between basically like union reps and this plutocrat who is, you know, proving his working man bona fides by repping their money. Like, I get, what is that role of the intermediary between people in union roles who have the relationships with these institutions that are handling their assets and their retirements?
It's a really interesting story. It's actually one I go into extensively in the book, and it's fraught with all sorts of weird conflicts, but it also, I think, has some very real potential for workers. So basically what you have, particularly with the public funds, which is where the lion's share of the assets are, is they're run by these boards of trustees. And these trustees basically come from two sources. One is they tend to be elected by the members themselves, by the workers themselves, often, not always, but often with a lot of union say. So in the Billions example you'd be talking about with these fire and police pension funds, very often what happens is a significant part of the board, sometimes a little less than half, sometimes a little more, sometimes exactly half of the board, will be elected by the firefighters or by the police officers themselves to be on the boards of these funds. The other source of trustees usually is politicians. It can be in some states and cities, if you're the attorney general or you're the treasurer or you're the governor, you're either automatically on the board or you get to appoint members to the board. And so you get this mix of basically politicians and workers who serve on these boards. And the interesting thing is that, you know, years ago, one of the things that I write about in the book is that I think that these pension funds, kind of like the police and fire ones you just named, have actually played a very good role when it comes to one piece of the story, just a piece, but it's securities fraud lawsuits or deal lawsuits. You know, a lot of times, you know, if you look at the big cases like Enron and WorldCom, things like that, oftentimes the only folks who step forward to do anything about that are funds like these police and fire or other public pension funds, teacher funds sometimes, will actually do something and bring a lawsuit and not just sit back and get defrauded and not do anything. So one time I was actually speaking to a sheriff on one of these boards, and he said, and I asked him, why you do these suits? And he basically said, you know, half my guys carry axes and the other half carry guns, talking about these fire and police funds, and we're just not going to let ourselves get ripped off. We're going to do something about it. They view themselves as sort of policemen of the market in a way, policemen and women of the market. And I think in that role, they've done some really good things for their members, of course, but even for the rest of us out there who don't have their clout, who are trapped in individually managed 401ks if we're lucky enough to have any retirement, and just don't have the clout that they do.
So that's a positive, and we'll get, you know, to all of these areas of intervention that you see and outline. But it seems like one of the contradictions that kind of flows, you know, innately out of public sector or private sector unions, for that matter, having all this money in the market, is that they could be, you know, essentially profiting by their own demise. Maybe not, you know, individually, obviously, if you're, you know, retired and the state isn't going to attempt to retroactively kind of put your pension plan under an austerity budget, which is another thing that I think we need to look out for. But that being said, mm-hmm. You know, you can, you know, once you're retired and, you know, the pension fund is doing well, I guess that, you know, that puts you in the role of somebody who's sort of benefiting from capital plays to some extent. But structurally, you know, I guess if you're invested in a company that's outsourcing your job or increasing automation, or companies that are, you know, paying people in Washington or at the state level to gut unions or help bring up something like the Janus case, which maybe we could touch on later, you're in a system which is undermining at best, if not kind of directly, you know, really viciously harming working class and union interests. So can you explore that contradiction?
Yeah, I think it's a very real problem. I think it's a serious problem. But I also think it's something that if we keep our wits about us and stay, you know, focused on exercising the tools that we would have at our disposal, it's a surmountable problem. And, you know, a lot of people have the attitude like, oh my goodness, we're getting ourselves into some compromised situation here. Let's get out as quickly as possible. We can't be part of this at all. Well, my view is, you know what, let's stop and think for a second and ask, you know, how can we use these same levers of power that could be used against us to actually help workers?
Yep.
So let's put it in some concrete terms. You're absolutely right. It's a problem. And I actually do go on about this at some length in the book. To me, the worst example, the nightmare example, is a lot of these investments that some of these public pension funds have done in privatization.
Yep.
So you've got situations, we have very real situations that have happened, where some public pension fund that invests the retirement savings of some public worker actually makes an investment in a company whose whole purpose, or often through a private equity fund actually, whose purpose is basically to privatize the very services that those workers are providing to the government. We're talking about school services, schools, prisons, police, firefighting. I mean, there are private equity funds running private firefighting forces now. I mean, we know privatization is everywhere, and it's a serious problem when these very workers' retirement funds are invested in such companies. I spoke to a guy, this was actually reported by a story reported earlier by Bloomberg News years ago, but where a custodian whose own pension fund had been invested in a company called Aramark, which then showed up in the town, underbid his union for the job, and they'd be making $20 an hour. They would offer their jobs back for like $8.50 an hour. So the thing that you point your finger on is a real issue. However, one of the things that I point out in the book is that there have been a number of activists, you know, pension and labor side activists, who have really figured out how to deal with this problem. And the leverage cuts both ways. These private equity funds are dying to manage public pension fund money because it's a pot of money they can get their hands on. And that, therefore, gives these funds some leverage. You know, and there are a number of examples of this. Years ago, there was a little story actually in the Wall Street Journal about how some higher ups at, I think it was Blackstone, I want to say at the time, which is interesting. We'll come back to Blackstone in a minute, had come out and basically were attacking defined benefit pension plans. And so New York City or New York State, I forget which pension fund it was, basically just canceled the meeting with those guys. We're like, you know, we're supposed to have a meeting. We're not meeting with you. We're annoyed about this.
Yep.
And the next day, the company comes out and basically issues a statement. We support defined benefit pension plans. And, you know, recently, the New York City pension funds adopted a responsible contractor policy where they basically said, look, we are not going to do infrastructure investment unless, you know, we are seeing the hiring of union labor and or fair wage payment to fair wages and benefits, which, by the way, can help these all these funds because you now have new workers who are contributing into the funds.
Right.
And we're not going to invest, you know, unless we see that. And sure enough, Blackstone comes out for their infrastructure fund announcing we're going to follow along with this. So there have been a number of instances now. Some pension funds have said we're just not going to touch privatization at all. We're out. We're not investing in it. Others have said, you know what, we're only going to do it under certain conditions, whatever it may be, or we're going to adopt a responsible contractor policy, something like that. These are ways to make these worker pension dollars work for workers and not get ripped off and not get exploited in that particular way. So that's an example, I think, that can cut either way. And just to add one more point to that, Michael, which is, you know, all of these – the thing is you go back to the 1940s, 50s, 60s, even 70s in this country, and I don't mean to – you know, there were a lot of very serious problems with the country, with unions, particularly along issues of race and other issues that we still live with today. That having been said, there was a time, I think all of us would acknowledge, that unions were stronger then, much stronger than they are now. They had much higher rates of unionization. They had more money because there was more contributors, and they were more powerful then than they are today. And I think that that really helped workers, having those more powerful institutions. Yet if you go back, there were certainly accusations, and right accusations in some sense, that said they're so powerful, they're so influential in the Democratic Party, they're too close to the power structure, they're too much part of the power structure, and that can compromise them. And that's undoubtedly true. And I think it's also undoubtedly true for these pension funds with some of the investments that they do. That having been said, my view is I think that workers are better off with these pensions and their capital, you know, in the game and hopefully, you know, representing the interests of their workers and their retirement needs and so on and so forth, than sidelined. That's at least my view. And not everyone would agree, but
I mean, I think my view is from the most, you know, extreme radical position, which I guess I usually adopt, to the most, you know, potential operative position. I wherever there's a point of power, you should try to leverage it, period. And so, you know, this is a point of power. So that being said, you know, you talked about the Blackstone example, which I love. You talked about privatization, using union labor. You talked earlier about policing Wall Street and being an important point of shareholder lawsuits. Can you let me make this two parts. What are the various ways concretely that pensions can exercise this power? And then on the flip side, You know, there's people on the other side of this who are, you know, reading smart people like you and keeping up on this stuff. And it isn't just labor unions. I mean, this idea of kind of shareholder activism has, you know, has various interests. I mean, there's people who work on environmental issues. There's people who work on, mm-hmm. you know, issues having to do with human rights that implicate corporate governance. So there's been, I would imagine there's also an appetite amongst the corporate sector to very, very radically limit what shareholders can do in terms of social and policy provisions. So, or maybe I'm wrong, but maybe you could start with, what can unions do, and then is there already a backlash to that brewing that we need to look out for as well?
Okay, so first of all, on the piece of what can they do, I mean, in addition to some of the things that I just mentioned, you know, the responsible contractor policies or privatization policies and things of that nature, you know, one of the things, and this is a lot of the story in the book, is about the very productive role that these pension funds, the leadership role that these pension funds have played in the corporate governance movement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, corporate, you go back not that long, 10, 15 years ago, you know, corporations for a very long time have been entirely insular. You've got some board, a very, very clubby board, often a bunch of buddies who all know each other, were friends and went to school together and hung out, basically running the corporation in their own interests or as they see fit. You had a whole cult of the superstar CEO. You go back to the 80s and the 90s and some of these guys, you know, sort of a cult around the idea almost of, you know, you get the right CEO in and you know, never mind the company has, you know, 50,000 employees. It all comes down to this one guy and almost always a guy. And, you know, what's happened since, and there are a lot of reasons for it. I think the financial crisis played a big role, although this all started before it, but there's been a real move towards shareholder activism, generally speaking. It used to, the usual rule was always, what's a shareholder? Somebody who puts some money into the company and just shuts up and says nothing. Everything gets managed by the company itself. And, you know, the shareholder just passively hopes for the stock price to go up and for dividends. Well, you know, that's still a very common model, still the dominant model, but we've seen much more activism of a variety of sorts. And the public pension funds, particularly in corporate governance, have been absolutely, I think, the leaders of that movement. So what have they done? One piece is shareholder voting. You know, we have all sorts of complaints. People talk about, you know, all the problems with our political voting system and, you know, voter suppression efforts and, you know, voter ID and the back and forth fights along that and the Electoral College and so on and so forth. Well, you start to look at what goes on in corporate voting. In some ways, it's even worse. So, for example, a simple technical example, but I think it's illustrative. You know, if Donald Trump were running for president again, 2020, imagine if he could, you know, anybody could run against him, but only his name would be on the ballot in voting booths. Okay. Mm-hmm. That, you know, somebody else could run, but they'd have to spend millions and millions of dollars printing up their own ballots, sending them around to voters, getting the voters to bring them to the polls. That would be flatly unconstitutional in the political context, but that's exactly the way corporate elections have run forever. There's one ballot. The incumbent board members get to put their own name on it, and you can run against them. You just have to print up your own ballot and mail it to everybody, and it costs millions of dollars. And the only folks who can ever afford to do that are hedge funds. Well, I'll make a very long story short because it was in Dodd-Frank, and then it got struck down by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. There was a lawsuit. Long story short, the New York City pension funds and others launched a campaign for proxy access, and it very swiftly won. They filed shareholder proposals. Now shareholders have a meaningful right to add, to actually have a competitive election to put board nominees and run it on the same ballot. You know, there's the same thing has happened with the move towards majority voting, to de-staggering boards, for example, so that boards, instead, it used to be that you could, for a while, you could only elect a third of the board every year rather than the whole board. All of this insulated managers from shareholders, and the corporate, and so the public pension funds picked up these issues and ran with them. And there's a lot of evidence that that actually was good for everybody. There's this proxy access, this ballot issue I was telling you about. There are a number of studies that show that it's improved. It correlates with increases in value and share price and things like that. So that's stuff that we've all benefited from. And these pension funds have been very involved in it. Not all of them have been successful. There have been efforts, for example, to get, you know, we have a weird model in this country, the CEO, the imperial CEO. Most American CEOs are also chairman of or women of the board of directors. And that's unusual. You look at England, Germany, Canada, Australia, you look at most of, there's a different person who's chairman of the board or chairperson of the board and versus CEO. And that's, you know, that also poses problems, but we've been less successful in actually on that issue. Some success in splitting CEO chair there. But those are all examples and so of actual things that have been done aside from the issues I mentioned earlier that the pension funds, these worker funds have taken the lead on. That's all union funds and public pension funds have done all that. And I think it's benefited themselves because let's not forget they are all about furnishing the retirements of their workers and improving that value, improving that accountability is important for funding those retirements. And then you asked about the backlash and or what are the challenges. Oh, and by the way, you know, your point about, you know, environmental issues, social issues, you know, what are the interesting things about this? And I think this comes to your backlash point is, you know, what's considered political, which is read as illegitimate, and what's considered an investment consideration. And in this world, there's this back and forth about that, about what's political, which is, you know, supposedly inherently illegitimate versus what's investment. And, you know, my own view on this is, you know, a lot of this stuff, they try to code it as political, but it's not. And then the other piece of it is, well, so what's the big deal if it is on occasion? And so let me talk about
it's
that
like
first.
Political analysis. No, I'm just going to say, I mean, it's not as if political analysis doesn't factor into any, you know, financial strategy regardless. It's an artificial boundary, which makes sense. And
right.
I guess, it makes sense, obviously, in a limited and parochial sense. But certainly, I mean, you can make the case. I mean, I wouldn't want to subordinate corporate conduct to say at the end of the day, the only thing that really matters is dollar value return. But at the same time, it does seem to me that you could easily make the case that many quote unquote political issues, whether it's, you know, environmental livability or, you know, certainly in the issues we're talking about of, you know, worker safety, future retirement savings as an example, as what one of, you know, infinite number of examples, like it's both political and absolutely within the realm of economic concern. But anyways, please go ahead.
That's right. Yeah. And that's exactly right. And, you know, I think it's sort of a like a delegitimizing attempt to delegitimize certain strategies or certain ways of thinking. But in fact, you know, trying to sort out, oh, this is an investment and this is all politics, et cetera, is not easy and not necessarily desirable. And if you look back, of course, you know, today, all this corporate governance stuff I mentioned, proxy access, de-staggering the boards, majority voting, CEO, and by the way, I didn't even mention some of the other ones, say on pay. You know, the pensions were a big part of pushing for that, for say on pay, which gave shareholders the first meaningful opportunity to vote on the pay of CEOs. The CEO worker pay ratio, for the first time this proxy season, which is right now, we're in it, where companies are holding their annual meetings and reporting. For the first time this year, we are seeing reports required by law because the pension funds helped push the SEC to actually issue the rule, and not just pension funds, union funds and others, like the AFL-CIO Office of Investment was involved with that. We're seeing the first time the CEO worker pay ratio be reported, how much CEOs make relative to the median worker. So this is all stuff that they've done. Now, you go back not that long ago, and this was widely derided as being just political. Oh, why are these guys fighting for shareholder voting rights? It's all politics. So it's not real. Today, it's just accepted as absolutely mainstream, you know, investment consideration. And, you know, we're seeing the same story unfold today with environmental issues. All right. For years, pension funds, big public pension funds, again, I think New York City is an example. For years, they've been making these environmental shareholder proposals where they basically go to a company and they file a shareholder proposal to get the company to, say, disclose more or do more about global warming issues, environmental issues. They lost year after year after year. They lost and lost and lost. And they were derided again as, oh, it's about politics, it's not about investment. Well, last year, for the first time, two of these proposals were adopted at energy companies, at oil and gas companies, to get them to do more, disclose more about environmental issues. Mainstream players who are not, you know, some of the big mutual funds, I believe Vanguard and BlackRock, came out in favor of these proposals. And so what just a few years ago was derided and perceived as just purely about politics and not having any legitimate investment concern, now is in part of the investment equation. And today we're seeing, you know, environmental, social, governance issues being part of the investment equation too. I mean, you know, it's obvious. If you know, from the stranded assets argument that basically says, you know, a lot of these oil and gas companies will never be able to drill a lot of these assets that they own because of what it'll do to the planet, to disclosures about the real risks that climate change actually poses to companies. This is all it's all today, I think, perfectly legitimate, you know, investment calculus. And so that's changed, and that's become important. And, you know, you mentioned the point about maximizing returns. This is where a lot of the fight has been. It's been a legal fight. It's been an ideological fight about what is a fund supposed to do? What is the company supposed to do? Is its sole mission in life to maximize returns, short-term returns, long-term returns, et cetera? Can it take other things into consideration? Is it really a conflict? Is there really a conflict between maximizing returns? Sometimes I think it clearly is. But there are many instances where taking these considerations into account, it correlates perfectly with or coheres perfectly with returns. So anyway, you get that exact dynamic that you pointed to before.
Can we touch on just briefly, and then we'll loop it all back? But I mean, give us we've talked about it on the show before, but it's important, I think, to refresh everybody and kind of anticipate what most likely will happen and potential scenarios around it. But what's your read on the Janus case, and kind of get everybody a bit up to speed on it again, if you can?
Well, you know, the legal issue is one that for 40 years was established, which is that under prior legal precedent in this Abood case, you couldn't make unions members pay for political activity, but you could make them pay for the benefits they received from basically having a union bargain collectively on their behalf, and they would get the benefits of that. And this has been squarely challenged in a First Amendment challenge. And, you know, as a little bit of the history, there was a Friedrichs case, the exact same issue, came before the Supreme Court, looked like Scalia was going to come out against the workers on this one. And we, as we all know, he passed away. And you know, I remember in that moment thinking that was sort of the high watermark of the whole Reagan reaction, that you know, Garland would get in and the Supreme Court would be 5-4 in the other direction, and things would move back. We all know what actually happened. And now with Gorsuch in there, I think there's real fear. I would be betting on it that the Supreme Court of the United States will strike down these agency fees. And those agency fees help fund particularly public sector unions. And, you know, when similar things have happened, like when similar things happened in Wisconsin, there were very, very sharp drops in unionization, and that was very concerning. So, on the other hand, you know, there are some other potential interesting possibilities. Well, one is that I think the unions have really tried to get out ahead of this issue and make the case to their own members why it's so valuable to be part of the union. And I am also somewhat hopeful that, for example, the recent successful teacher strike in West Virginia will enable unions to make the case to their workers to stay in and to keep paying and try to deal with this, you know, and just maybe the free rider problem. I mean, this is sort of a little bit hopeful, I'll admit. But and there are some other interesting possibilities, some places where collective bargaining hasn't been allowed that there could maybe be First Amendment challenges to on that, that so that may empower unions. So, look, I'm not actually a union labor guy. I'm more on the sort of the pension investment side. And right. So, I mean, one thing I will say is that, so from my perspective, is what would this do to the pension shareholder power?
Yeah.
And somewhat more encouraging is the fact that I looked at Wisconsin, actually. I looked at their pensions after, the Scott Walker debacle. And while unionization plummeted dramatically, the pensions are basically where they were before. That makes perfect sense because they're still under the same contracts and they're still paying in and so on and so forth. So to me, it's an indirect threat, what would happen with Janus, because what I worry about is if the Janus case does leave unions with fewer resources, are they still going to be able to use those resources to help protect the pensions? Because they are under threat, and the threat to pensions is a little bit different than this kind of unionization issue in Janus. To me, I mean, there are a number of other threats to pensions. One of them is this whole debate of, you know, over sort of fiduciary duty and what can pension trustees take into account. And, you know, it sort of flips back and forth. It's a bit of a political football. When Clinton was in office, there was a more liberal interpretation. And then when Bush came into office, it was a more narrow interpretation. And then Obama withdrew that and made it a little bit more liberal again. And, you know,
right.
Who knows what's going to happen with the Department of Labor now. But the other thing I'm really worried about is just the very strong pressure to convert all these big pension plans into individually managed 401k retirement accounts. Because if you look at those of us who are at least lucky enough to have anything, I suppose, but those of us in 401ks, we've got basically very little leverage compared to these big pension funds. Most of us don't know what's going on in our portfolios. A lot of us pay fees that we shouldn't pay. There's a lot of garbage offered to us in these things. And what I worry is now these big pension funds, the CalPERSs of the world, the California Public Employees Retirement System, the California Teachers Retirement System, the New York City pension funds, you break those up into millions of individually managed accounts rather than a big $300 billion plus fund, a lot of the leverage disappears, goes away, is fractured. And to me, the analogy is like, to me, it's like a pension is like a union and a 401k is like right to work.
Right.
It's like we're all broken up into these individually managed accounts and we have tiny stakes. Nobody cares if we make the phone call saying, hey, why did this, that, the other happen? We have too little leverage. And by the way, I should say there are efforts to even organize and, you know, individual investors in that way, these individual 401k holders, and they're out there. And I would encourage that, but I still, you know, to me, the first order of business would be to, you know, at least protect the collective nature of these funds, because without that, I think a lot of that leverage and power is lost.
Right. Good luck as an individual consumer getting Blackstone to reverse itself and release a press release going, no, of course we support defined benefits. Right.
Right. Right, exactly right.
The book is The Rise of the Working Class Shareholder, Labor's Last Best Weapon. David Weber, fascinating. Thanks so much.
Michael, thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
Okay, take care. Bye.
All right, and obviously you can find a link to the book as well as all of Professor David Weber's information on Majority.fm. This show is possible because of members, because of you individual shareholders in this show, majority.fm/become a member. If you're watching, if you're listening on iTunes to the public version of the show, there's a link to the Become a Member page, as well as to Jamie Peck Patreon, the Patreon page for the Michael Brooks Show. Michael Brooks Show, usually 7 p.m. Tuesday night, but since we're on vacation next week, there's going to be two this week. So tomorrow, Friday, starting at 6 p.m., Assemblyman Lee Carter, DSA Assemblyman in Virginia, is going to be a guest. Netha Khan, who's a Pakistani New York journalist, and the debut, the first animated impression cartoon. It's happening tomorrow night. It's big. Lot happening. Get the whole thing. And next week, we're dropping two interviews, actually, that are normally going to be illicit or for patrons only, but they're actually going to be on the public feed, one with Dr. Christopher Ryan, the other with Mark Blythe. Patreon.com/TMBS. Also, JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Get the Majority Report blends. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Anything else? What else? We're at, Sam mentioned it yesterday, at past 250 on YouTube. Thank you. Keep spreading the word, and we'll see you on the fun half.
The era of the pajama boy is over.
It's like being, really, like being gay in the 1950s.
To help with connectivity.
Hello, this is Mitt Romney.
And he is turning over the tables in the swamp.
So-called progressives are actually regressive.
And what is Aleppo?
That's a fucking good point.
Tomorrow's news today.
It's working, and it's very exciting.
I'm not going to jail. You think I'm going to jail?
Please don't try to talk over me, which is what liberals do.
You seem to be a bit of a glum bucket.